seeking and the object seeking mind. And last year, John Briggs, who is our dear Dharma friend and priest who died recently, was really encouraging us as a board to develop a diversity statement for our Sangha. And out of his encouragement, the board really wrestled with this. You know, what does this mean and what do we want to say? And so finally, we formulated a diversity statement for our website that we thought really expressed the Dharma. And so this was like a very important step, but when I really read our diversity statement, it was so powerful, and I thought, wow, I mean, we as a Sangha really haven't together explored this diversity statement and really wondered, well, what does this mean about our practice to embody this statement? So this is kind of what I want to begin talking about tonight. And we've actually sort of planned the next 3 months of our program to give many opportunities for us as a Sangha to study, to talk, to practice in relation to our diversity statement. So I'm going to read it to you. And it's on the website. And there's copies at the back, too, if anybody wants to take it home to kind of live with. The diversity statement says, or our diversity statement says, the highest value of Buddhist practice is to shine the light of awareness on habits of mind that perpetuate prejudice and discrimination so all may wake up together. This includes learning how we are conditioned to separate ourselves by race, gender, age, ability, sexual orientation, and other forms of cultural identity. So, wow, this statement says this is our highest value. To shine the light of awareness on habits of mind that perpetuate prejudice and discrimination, so we may all wake up together. So this seems to me, well, not so easy to live out. And this is certainly not something we can do alone. And we're hoping that through this time, we can together develop our capacity to practice skillful means through working on our habits of prejudice and discrimination. So there was an article that I found on the Buddhist Peace Fellowship website by Mushim Patricia Ikeda, and the article was entitled White Awake. And she says that there's a tendency of white Buddhist practitioners to think that to not be racist is to be colorblind, to deny seeing race at all. She writes, during a recent workshop, one white Buddhist exclaimed, I don't care if you're purple, green, or whatever. I just see you as a person. So to kind of paraphrase her commentary, she was saying that she feels this view gets sort of entangled in maybe a misunderstanding of what Buddhism means by ultimate reality. Because the meaning is that this unconditioned life transforms our conditioned life, transforms our habits of mind and prejudice into seeing the interconnection of all beings. But that's different than to say there's one ultimate truth and therefore all lives matter is a better way to say it rather than Black Lives Matter. So, but really Buddhism says there are two truths, the unconditioned and the conditioned. And it's not that the ultimate reality is the real truth and the conditioned reality is the fake truth. No, they're both true. And Dogen writes about the twisted vine, the entwining of delusion and enlightenment, and that this is the Dharma. So I don't know if you're familiar with Jack Engler, but he's kind of known for writing about spiritual bypassing. And he says spiritual bypassing is the tendency to cling to the transcendent while denying our utterly human tendency to avoid looking closely at our, quote, object-seeking mind. We have a tendency to fail to investigate the ways that we create a separation between self and other and create categories of evaluation or judgment based on our own fixed view. And really, language, concepts, and perceptions work in this way. But we all know that the Dharma, Buddha says the causes of our suffering are exactly this, the clinging to a fixed view or turning away from pain and suffering and what's uncomfortable. But this gift of the truth from the Buddha is also something that I think slips away for us. Western philosophy and social psychology call this othering. And I, when I was in this training group, I was in training to be a pastoral counselor, and I was in a group. And there were four of us, three white women and one African-American woman pastor. And at one point she was sharing with us how difficult it was to grow up in the South and experience racism as a child. And one of us said to her, "Oh, I really understand. That must have been so hard." And suddenly she got really mad and she said, "No. You don't understand. How could you understand what it was like to be a black girl in the South?" She said, "You would be much more honest if you said you don't understand." So with this shift, we as white women had to come down from our white privilege. And really, the gratification we were trying to get by saying, "I understand." So the concept of othering, I was talking to Jeff about this, was, I just learned this last week, was first developed by Simone de Beauvoir. Now, at least from my generation, you would know who she is, but she was one of the first feminist philosophers from, and she's from France, she was an existentialist. And she wrote The Second Sex, and I found out in 1949, so it's even more recent than I thought. But this is what she said. "The category of the other is as primordial as consciousness itself. In the most primitive societies, in the most ancient mythologies, one finds the expression of a duality, that of the self and the other. Otherness is a fundamental category of human thought. Thus it is that no group ever sets itself up as the one without at once setting up the other over against itself. In small town eyes, all persons not belonging to the village are strangers and suspect. To the native country, all who inhabit other countries are foreigners. Jews are different for the anti-Semite. Negroes are inferior for American racists. Aborigines are natives for colonists. Proletarians are lower class for the privileged." This is what she wrote. So it makes me think of Larcia Hawkins. Do you know who she is? She's the first black woman professor to receive tenure at Wheaton College in Illinois. And this is a Christian university. And she kind of prided herself in helping students look at basic assumptions and stereotypes. And so recently she decided to wear a hijab as a symbolic gesture to support the Muslim community and to stand up for othering that was part of the theology that was being taught. And she was immediately fired. This is a Christian university. So it's often out of fear. You know, in Buddhism, we say there are three poisons greed, hate, and delusion. And my teacher says the fourth poison is fear. Because out of fear, our bodies mobilize. And this is what leads to stereotypes and othering. So this happened a long while ago, but I was walking down a street in Hyde Park, and I heard this sort of rumbling noise behind me. And I didn't know what it was. I turned, and there was this whole group of adolescent boys, like, running towards me. And I didn't really understand what was happening. And all of a sudden, I was being surrounded, and somebody was grabbing my purse. And I don't know why, but I fought back, and I fell on the ground, and they ran off. And I got up, and I was kind of in a daze. I didn't know what to do. And then I looked, and they were all running back towards me, this group of boys. And I was so in shock that I didn't even run. But then I looked again, and there was a police car at the end of the block. And so I realized, oh, they're not running back to me. They're running away from the police. So I was so lucky. But I have to tell you that for months, I would walk down a street in Hyde Park, and it turned out these group of boys were African American. And every time I saw a black man, I said, oh, maybe it was him. Maybe it was him. So out of that one experience of fear, I created a stereotype. So I don't know if you know Peter Levine. He's a somatic psychologist who developed this concept called the orienting reflex, because he had been able to notice that if somebody, that if you hear a loud sound or if some strange person walks by that looks like a shaman or something like that, and you, at first you're afraid. You don't first say friend, really. And you turn to sort of evaluate friend or foe or danger or safe or whatever. But that's a reflex. And so the fear, this fear factor is built in just for our survival, but it's physiological. But we have to remember that fear isn't just based on physical danger, because fear goes through every privileged identity that we have. Fear of losing that identity. So othering is a category of difference plus power. Inferior, superior, majority, minority, good, bad, right, wrong. Our minds do this. So we know that Buddhism offers an explanation of this. Buddhism, too, understands that it's built in, that we have this object-seeking mind, that we need to cling to a fixed identity and to feel like we're a separate self. And we also have an impulse to avoid, to turn away for something that's painful or uncomfortable. But Buddhism says this is really the source of suffering, because the object-seeking mind pulls us away from the truth, which is that we're all interconnected and we're all together realizing the gift of life. The thing is that this tendency to other actually goes on an unconscious level. It often functions outside of our awareness. And we have defense mechanisms that protect us from our own prejudice and discrimination. These defenses help us turn away. I was on the faculty of a graduate training, of a graduate program in psychology. And I was a good colleague of an African-American woman psychologist who taught the diversity class. And I really valued our connection. And she was very interested in doing research on racism amongst the students, and there was some sophisticated survey that had been developed to tap into unconscious racism. And you would, like, there would be flashes of, you know, people of different color, and then a situation, and then you were timed, and you had to give your kind of immediate reaction. And she wanted me to ask my students if they would fill out this, do this online survey. So I thought, well, if I'm going to ask my students to do it, I better do it first. So I took this survey, and it came up. I was racist. I was high on the scale. And I can't really describe the feeling I had to have to go to my colleague and tell her that. But I was thinking about this because it happened a long time ago. But when I told her, she didn't say anything. Like, she didn't say, you know, oh, that was brave of you to do that, or, you know, that she didn't try to rescue me from this truth that I had to look at. But she stood there in this kind of presence, and I didn't feel her judgment. And actually, it didn't change our relationship. But the fact that she didn't try to rescue me, you know, kept the mirror turned back on me. So, you know, maybe together, how do we face our racism? How do we not turn away? Because I'm responsible for the projections I bring to a person of color, of a transgendered person, or a disabled person. But I also need to be aware that perhaps what they see is a white middle-class woman who might not understand them. And to realize the implications when I can say, oh, I didn't think of myself as a white person. So maybe some of you know Hakuan. He's kind of a Zen, well, he was, I guess, a Rinzai master, sort of a Zen master. He wrote in the 1700s, and he wrote a book called Four Ways of Knowing, which I've spent a lot of time working with. And he makes a distinction between discriminatory thought and differentiation. And, you know, this is part of the Buddhist Dharma, really. He says, I warn you strongly against discriminating, has and has not. To have a single eye is to see without discrimination. Everything is unique. There is no difference. Discrimination is dependent upon concepts and words. Just as a net cannot capture the flowing stream, concepts and words cannot capture the aliveness and richness of life. Usefulness is a primary virtue of the discriminating mind, but judging everything according to its use also comes from the same tendency to reduce variety of value to one color. So our categories and labels don't really inform, they reduce all of us to less than who we are. So then Hakuan distinguishes the differentiating mind. So when, with awakening, this discriminating mind is shattered, and the richness and fullness of life breaks through the pale gray cast of thought. And Suzuki says this too. He says, another way to explain reality is by differentiation. Differentiation is equality, and things have equal value because they're different. If men and women are the same, then the distinctions between men and women have no value. Because men and women are different, men are valuable as men, and women are valuable as women. to be different is to have value. In this sense, all things have equal absolute value. Each thing has absolute value and thus is equal to everything else. This is so beautiful. Difference means that there's something significant to honor in the difference. And in this opening and honoring, our essential interconnectedness also arises. So one day I went for a walk during a break, and I was walking down the street, and I saw out of the corner of my eye what already I'm categorizing. I saw a man who seemed very disheveled and was shuffling. And I thought, oh, a homeless person. And he was far enough away, and I realized I had a choice. I could just not turn and look. I could just keep walking. Or I could turn and look. Most of the time, I don't even realize that I have that choice. But that day, I turned toward him. He hurried forward towards me and began to tell me how he had just left loaves and fishes, which, for anyone who doesn't know, it's a shelter for homeless people, because someone there had been mistreating him, and he wanted to beat him up. So he went on with his story, and then I listened and finally opened my wallet, and all I had was a $20 bill. So I gave it to him. He thanked me, and I turned to walk on. And then he called me back. And again, I thought, do I go on or do I turn? And at this point, I was a little anxious. It's like, oh, he's calling me back. But I turned back and he said, because you gave me this, I'm not going to beat that person up anymore. So can you feel that, though? In that moment, he wasn't the other anymore. You know, we were connected. We were together, and something happened between us. So I felt joy. So breaking through the object-seeking mind liberates us. So in sitting zazen, we're doing both. We're practicing staying aware of how our mind works, this object-seeking mind. And then we're also letting go into emptiness, into stillness, where dualisms are broken through and the Buddha mind of wisdom can break out. There's this thing called the Seneca heresy. I don't know if you're all familiar with this, but it was sort of a tendency within, I think, even Buddhism to say that it's the mind, the spiritual mind, that's of the essence, and the body is separate. So there was a tendency, I think, in the past to try to say that the essence, again, is the spirit. The body, or our embodiedness, isn't important, and actually we're sort of transcending that. But Dogen writes about this, and he says, essence and form are not divided. The principle that body and mind are one reality is being constantly spoken by the Buddha. If there is a time when body and mind are one reality, and another time when they're not one reality, then it might naturally follow that Buddhist preaching has been false. So this is also an important piece here. Embodiment matters. So if embodiment matters, then it's essential that we work with our responses to differences that are often activated when we encounter someone of another race or ethnicity or gender. So, along this line of embodiedness, There's a wonderful koan in the Hidden Lamp called Tara's Vow, and this was written in the 16th century from Tibet. And this koan tells a story of Moon of Wisdom, a woman who later became the goddess Tara, which is the emanation of Avalokiteshvara, the goddess of compassion. And as Moon of Wisdom, she was a very devoted practitioner, devoted to the Dharma, and a monk came up to her and said, because of your virtuous actions, you were born in a body, but unfortunately, a female body. So if you want to attain complete enlightenment, this monk says to her, pray that you will be reborn in a male body. So she responded by confronting him on his categorizing of male as the only embodied being that can achieve enlightenment. She said, your attachment to your idea about man and woman is a delusion. And then she vowed, until there was an end to samsara, she would come back embodied as a woman. So our particular embodiment makes a difference. And remember, difference is equal. So I'm going to try to explain this to you. I've recently become much more aware because of certain situations that if I have a strong opinion about something, you know, I'll say it in my mind, or I'll say it in a conversation with someone else. But I didn't fully realize how much I think I'm right. I have a strong opinion, but it's also that I'm right and the other person is wrong. And, you know, it's like, okay. But once I can see that, oh, I'm feeling this very strongly and I'm very upset, and that's because I think I'm right. So, but you can do something here. Like, you could say, okay, but what if he's right or she's right? And then, no, I'm coming to you in a minute. No, it's, what if she's right or he's right? And then if you really stay with it, this is sort of like what I'm going to be suggesting to working with this object-seeking mind. If I really stayed with, well, what if he's right? Then I have to listen again. Well, now, what did he say? And then I begin to see, oh, I didn't hear that, or I didn't hear that. But at the same time, that doesn't mean I'm wrong. So it's a tricky thing because I can also come back and say, okay, well, I might not be right. Maybe he's not right, but I'm not wrong and he's not wrong. And somehow, if you go back and forth like that, or at least when I was in this experience, suddenly I dropped down and I felt like I was in this pool or this ocean. Because in a way, I didn't know anything here. And dropping into that pool, that's the emptiness. That's the place where all these fixed views, you know, break up. And then we don't know what's going to happen next. In a way, and that's where the courage is to kind of live in that not knowing, especially in these moments of othering, a fixed view, or I'm right, you're wrong. And I have Clem's permission to share this because a couple of weeks ago, I thought I was Doan. So Doan is supposed to bring the flowers for the altar. So I love to do that. And so I worked really hard and I created this whole like floral arrangement with a red flower and I brought it here. And then all of a sudden Clem walks in with his flower arrangement. And it turns out, no, he's Doan, not me. And so it was like, so I thought, oh, well, Clem, I brought some flowers. And I had put them out there, but I was really attached to my flowers. I mean, I know it sounds real trivial, but it was very powerful because I still wanted him to go look at my flowers and say, oh, you know, I'll put your flowers on the altar. So I sat with it, and you know, I was just kind of walking around, and Clem's flowers were still on the altar. So finally I said, oh, Clem, did you look at my flowers? And he said, yes, I did. And he said, but I can go on, and I want a kind of simplicity in the flowers. So then it was like, oh my God, look at his flowers. Suddenly, I saw his flowers, how he saw them. You know, I saw the beautiful simplicity, and my attachment to my flowers just disappeared. So I was so grateful, Clem, because you were open. You went and looked at my flowers. Yeah. And so there was this, like, something happened that allowed us each to have what we felt. And at the same time, my whole perception completely changed. So that's the breaking out of the object-seeking mind. So, I don't know, essentially this talk is meant to be an invitation to invite all of us to work with this theme of othering and learning how to practice with our object-seeking mind. This is how we can embrace our diversity statement. Our real issue isn't to figure out how to become a more diverse Sangha, but rather for us to engage in this inner growth, to wrestle with our object-seeking mind, and then have that break up, and we fall into the differentiating mind, the mind of the Buddha, where wisdom arises. And I'll just end with a wonderful quote from Reverend Zenju Urthelin Manuel, who is an African-American lesbian Zen priest in Oakland. And her book is going to be one of our resources, The Way of Tenderness. And she's been invited to come here. We don't know for sure if she is. I know she is, but I don't know if she's coming here too. But anyway, this is what she says. When we are bothered by someone, something, or ourselves, that is the knock of freedom. If we shut out the uninvited guest, then that is going back to sleep. If we really want freedom, what is shut out will return and knock on the door. Knock, knock, it's me again. Thank you. Oh, thank you for listening. And we have a little time if people have, you know, thoughts or anything that came up for them or questions or Karen. Yeah, beautiful. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're really wanting us to realize it's sort of like every moment, you know, we're in that sort of pivot of turning towards the openness, realizing, you know, whatever the discrimination is happening in the moment, and engaging. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Oscar?
I guess I'm really just want to reflect or echo what Karin mentioned. This is, thank you for initiating this topic. It's an amazing topic. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous topic. There's no end to it. It covers all of the Dharma. And in trying to relate to this topic, for me, it's been useful to distinguish between the larger tendency, the global tendency, I'll say, of sentient beings such as ourselves to differentiate, and then as a subset of that, we distinguish and have prejudices. Relating to social identities. Those two things are very important, are both very important, and like the twisted vine, they're not really separate. But it's helpful for me to understand, to put them in categories, conceptual categories. So the whole of the Dharma for me, you know, the third ancestor said, the way is not difficult for one who has no preferences. He wasn't talking about social discriminations, racial, gender-based, sexual, any, whatever. Mm-hmm. He was talking in the global sense.
Yeah, I see.
Mm-hmm. But in our conditional life, we have, and in our conditional life, a very important aspect is how we relate to other people, and particularly those people who we other. I mean, I other everything. I other the ceiling, my foot, you. That's just what I do. That's all. That's just my thought. That it's helpful to not conflate those, although they're inseparable. It's useful to be able to talk, to know which one you're talking about at any point in time.
You mean the social construction part versus the more broad way in which
we
always are making preferences and making others into objects or anything into an object.
Right, and by social construction, I take that you mean what the mission stage,
the diversity,
more relating to
diversity
on the social, social context.
That's that. Sorry. Yes.
I want to comment on how I was struck with your honesty about staying, taking this test and discovering who are racist. Thank you. here and share this with us. It is so hard every day to be an other in our culture. And I don't know how to make that up to you. I've only had a few experiences where I was the only white face in a room with a group of African Americans, and I was suddenly aware of how uncomfortable that was, and how I didn't really talk their language, and how I really didn't understand them. And it took 3 years for them to trust me. And I thought about how that is an everyday experience for me. And I just want to say that is one of my heartfelt mission, is to move through this. And also at another level, to make amends for the horrible damage that we have done to our brothers and sisters over the centuries. And I hope we can find our way to do that.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Yes, I wanted to say that when you were describing the othering that we do, mainly self and other, it occurred to me that it seems to be the nature of things that everything wants to remain in a static state. And I believe we spend a good deal of our lives trying to preserve the current state of affairs. But you know how they say first impressions are the most important? I think this is the really hurtful part of how we objectify things, because we objectify ourselves as the center of the universe, and we objectify others as not. And we tend to fix that identity on them, and it's very difficult to initiate change after that occurs.
The initial kind of forming of the concept or the perception of the other person.
Exactly. Yeah. You create them. For whatever reason, things impress us. And we tend to stick with that.
But that's part of what I think it's good for us.
The truth is that none of this is true, is that nothing is in a static state.
Right. So even to recognize how powerful that is in us, to me, is a really important thing. It happens instantly, really, before we even know it. And so that kind of alertness and you know, catching those things, it's a practice.
I've heard 30 seconds thrown out there when you're in person.
Yeah, and there's go ahead.
Associated with the ego and associated with that act of othering things, objectifying other things. And if you know, motivation for compassion wasn't enough, the this thing was saying was that there's evidence that overactivity in that action of objectifying, grasping, and othering actually leads to things like depression, anxiety, and even Alzheimer's. So not only are we harming that external world by othering, we're harming ourselves.
Right.
And that's kind of obvious when the things that you talked about when you recognize it and you didn't have a choice about it, there's your freedom.
Right.
There's your relief from your suffering.
Thank you. I mean, that's the beauty of the Dharma, that the release of the othering liberates everybody. Yeah, thank you. Jim.
Well, I know you and Oscar are about to go off to an intensive period of practice.
Mm-hmm.
And congratulations in advance.
Good luck, you mean.
Good luck. I think one of the most powerful things that I found in doing such kind of practice is that at least I don't know if it's still true, but we would get up early in 4:30 to sit at the beginning at 5 in the morning, and we would do zazen for two periods of watching meditation in between, and then we would get up for chanting, and we were very settled and focused at that time, especially as the intensive went on. And the first thing that we chanted, the very first thing was, all my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, I now fully avow. And I think that's so brilliant because, you know, it's taking, just going back and reminding us that, you know, You can do these practices, but stay connected to this huge situation
right.
Discriminating mind, and stay connected to that and acknowledge that.
Right.
Acknowledge that right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we keep needing to do. Right. That's where you started your talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we keep needing to acknowledge that.
Right.
And if we really keep acknowledging that, you know, the way that you were brought up, the ways that the things we heard, the way people were treated around us, and so forth. If we keep remembering that and acknowledging these, you know, not to mention, you know, how many hundreds of thousands of years of culture that's still affecting us. We stay connected to that. Then that, I think that's what we have to do. We start from there.
We start from there.
We have a chance.
Right.
We start from that awareness.
Right.
Thank you very much for your talk.
Yes. Thank you. Did you want to say something, Linda?
Did you want to start now?
Well, I mean, I if you want to say something.
Just listening to Jim took me back to my time at Zen Center when practicing with that. I realized my belief is that our country is suffering because it's never faced its history, and that I really think we need a truth and reconciliation process like South Africa did, and for our Native people, First People, and our African American brothers and sisters, and I'm becoming. I feel like we're never going to heal. We're never going to have the country we would like to have if we don't do this. The wounds are so deep, and it's gotten so painfully ugly. And this last election, I'm sorry to be political, but it's like, you know, I'm 9 years old. And I mean, if I feel that, it must be horrendous for Muslim people who are wondering whether they're going to have to register for LGBTQ people who are wondering, am I going to, if I transition, am I going to be able to change my birth certificate?
Mm-hmm.
For African American people who are dealing with terrible police forces
mm-hmm.
in most countries in the United States that need desperately need training and
Right. And may, I guess I, we may this be a safe sangha where we can honestly and openly pour our hearts out in this way.
I would like to, I would hope that the Buddhist community,
mm-hmm.
I mean, talk to other Buddhist communities, talk to people at Buddhist Peace Fellowship, because, I mean, if truth and reconciliation is not a new idea, Tanashi Post has proposed that a lot of people have, that this is something that needs to be done, and I think a social movement could make that happen.
So we have...
Here's something really quick. I don't know if this has anything to do with anything, but I was thinking as you're talking about all these different nationalities and everything, that I have 7 children, they're all grown, and I, I have a grandchild that's almost half Filipino. I have another grandchild on the way that's going to be half Costa Rican. You know, I have an African American daughter-in-law and that I just adore. And it's my hope that we all come together. And I feel like when we're practicing in Buddha's way, that we are. Practicing peace in this way, that we are being the calm in the lifeboat, that we are being the calm one and spreading that calm and hopefully, spreading that by just loving everyone that's around us.
Yes.
And I don't know if that's...
That has to make a difference.
Yes, I think it makes a big difference. And I don't know if that's naive, but I think that love is the answer. So, and I believe that's what we're doing.
I'm aware we're going over time, so maybe we can just we can stay and talk to each other, but maybe it's important to. Stop. I do want to say that the program, which I think Karen's over there, right, for the next 3 months, like, for example, Alan Tanaki's coming, who's one of the founders of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. He'll be here in February. I just feel like we're going to be having lots of opportunities to explore this topic together. So.